and welcome once again to Convergence. I'm Ellen Taylor, along with Michelle McAloon. It's a show where we discuss deeper issues that affect us all in our faith and culture and life. Good morning, Michelle.
Good morning, Ellen. How are you?
Or afternoon, because you know, Michelle is still in Germany, locked down for month 657.
It's kind of s'morning noon here.
It's
yeah, that's right.
We're glad you're here and on board. Today, we bring in a guest who's got quite the conversation going in the internet, in the magazine, where he is editor-in-chief, and it's The Public Discourse. You can reach them at thepublicdiscourse.com. So we bring in Dr. R.J. Snell. Welcome, and good morning, Doctor.
Good morning. Thank you so much for having me. Good to talk to you.
Great. So give us an overview, The Public Discourse. That sounds like a meaty topic to have for an online magazine. What's your aim and your purpose?
Yeah, thank you. So The Public Discourse is the online journal of the Witherspoon Institute, which is a research center in Princeton, New Jersey. And The Public Discourse, now well into its second decade, believes that the meatiest matters of public life, ethics, religion, morality, marriage, death, bioethics, that these are not just matters of emotion or force, but we can in fact reason about them together. And that reason isn't simply a tool for winning, but reason can in fact discover the truth about things which matter most to our common life together.
Okay. On January 31st, the editors of Public Discourse published a beautiful article addressing the concerns amongst conservatives in the shadow of one of the most politically liberal government elected in recent history. And it was actually an invitation for conversation to begin to speak about conservative goals and conservative aims.
Yeah, that's correct. So that was actually my first day on the job. Ryan Anderson, who's the founding editor of Public Discourse, had just begun that day as the president of the Ethics and Public Policy Center in Washington, D.C. And as I was starting the new position as editor-in-chief, my editorial staff and I decided that there's a lot of circular firing squad going on right now amongst conservatives after the heightened a drama of the Trump administration, and we thought it was time for the circular firing squads to end and for political, religious, and intellectual leaders to think really hard about the next steps. We think a lot's on the line right now, and we don't have, or we're not sympathetic to the self-indulgence of not working together to address really serious matters, things like religious freedom, the future of marriage, how to educate our children, and so on.
You make a good point, Dr. Snell, because it seems that even in like-minded groups, they are sitting on the real estate they've acquired in their position, and they seem unwilling to have conversations about how to move good ideas forward because they're kind of stuck in there. This is the corner I've staked my claim on, and I'm not going to engage. And so it feels like even if we are speaking with people that are like-minded, that we're not getting any further in the discussion. How do you propose that we move that forward?
Well, there's a lot of intellectual foment going on amongst the conservative movement. So there's a sense that what some people call the old consensus or the old fusionism, you might think of this as the world that William F. Buckley brought together. Sort of an anti-communist movement that brought together libertarians and traditionalists, economic conservatives or classical liberals. There's a mood among many that movement, and I'm making no statement about whether this is true or false, mm-hmm. that movement is dead. And many of the young conservatives are staking out new ground. Now, it's human nature, if you've had massive accomplishments and committed massive intellectual and financial resources to a movement or to an idea, that you're not ready to declare it to be dead or to move on to something else. And we think that leadership in the conservative and religious conservative movement needs to be willing to enter into conversation to, in some ways, save the ship. We think things are at a precarious moment, and we don't have time, we don't have the leisure to live in the past, and we cannot afford the kind of self-indulgence or self-aggrandizement, which assumes that the past is sufficient.
You talk about fusionism and about the limits of politics, of what politics can accomplish and what politics cannot accomplish. In that debate amongst conservatives now, would you say that is about what politics can accomplish or how politics should accomplish it?
Yeah, thank you. I think probably both. You know, conservatives are somewhat at a disadvantage. On the one hand, as you mentioned, there's enormous variety amongst conservatives. There's traditionalists, there's people who are concerned about economics, there's people who are concerned about life issues, and they don't always agree on everything. And at the same time, conservatives don't tend to have five-year plans to world domination. We're conservatives. We're trying to maintain what has been accomplished by the tradition. At the moment, the left, or liberals, democratic liberals, if you'd like, progressives, however you'd like to describe them, they're willing to run roughshod over everything. You know, there's an old feminist trope from second wave feminism that the politics is the personal and the personal is political. Everything in that idea is swamped under the domain of politics. The idea that from 9 to 5, you might be engaged in politics, but after that, you have your private life, your family life, your church life. That's all being undermined by a vision of politics which is all-encompassing and will not leave anyone alone in the privacy of their conscience, in the privacy of their home. They must claim absolutely everything. There are some conservatives who would like to play that game as well.
It sounds like a religion almost there, Dr. Snell, where you've got to go full in on it. Is there a way out of that? Like, can you disconnect from the politics that is trying to run your life 24 hours?
So let's think just of an example, the sort of contemporary woke moment of cancel culture. It is like religion, a kind of bad religion, where you can commit sins. Those sins are unforgivable. You are to be held accountable in public for those sins and even kind of sacrificed. And there's no possibility of redemption. People like myself, who are both conservative in the political sense and conservative in the religious sense, know that genuine religion allows for redemption, and know that genuine politics attempts to secure the liberties of individuals to engage in the drama of their own life, including the drama of their own salvation. The way out of this, I think, is twofold. The one is political. We stress that humans are free. We stress that the government is not an overweening power which lays claim to every aspect of our life. The political forces are not like Jesus, who claimed to all aspects of our lives. And then religiously, we continue to insist that the kingdom of God is not yet fully at hand, and political agents are not the vicar of Christ on earth. They have no claim to my soul. They have no claim to my life, political agents. They have claims to what they have claims to, which is, you know, taxation and roads and securing the common defense. That's it.
They can pick up the garbage, too. Yeah, I'll give them garbage.
Well, they're supposed to. I've been to New York. They don't always.
But this is in stark contrast to Democratic politics at this point. And I don't even want to say Democratic politics, but identity politics, where it has become all-consuming in finding the scapegoat for all the ills of the earth. You talk about establishing conversational partners and who should be involved. Who should be involved in talking about politics and conservative politics and forming a conservative agenda today?
No, of course, we're not going to disallow anyone from having any conversation they want, right? People are free, including people that I disagree with. In the consensus, or in the idea that we're suggesting of attempting to form a consensus among people who may disagree about quite a bit, it does seem to be the case that not everyone should be involved in that consensus. You know, the famous example is Buckley declaring that the Birchers, the members of the John Birch Society, were not welcome to publish in the National Review. We do think that there are some whose commitments are so violent or so outrageous or so irrational that while we in no way hinder or hamper their freedom of speech or their freedom of assembly, we don't really want them to be part of our conversation. I think, for instance, you know, members of QAnon, I probably are not going to invite to publish in public discourse. That being said, it doesn't matter to me just now whether you agree with me about every economic policy. There are huge swaths of prudential differences that are morally permissible. You and I disagree about immigration, tax policy, tax code. We disagree about Romney bucks. We, you know, should people get money for having children or not? That doesn't matter to me if you're willing to support religious freedom and religious liberty. You and I disagree about religion. You're Jewish, you're Muslim, you're Mormon. We have some real disagreements. That's fine. This isn't church. This isn't catechism class. You and I can be political allies to protect our families. So we're willing to engage in debate with anyone who wants to, and we're willing to engage in the attempt to form a new political consensus with anyone who is committed to basic liberties and who understands that there's a moral framework to the universe, even if we disagree about some of those conclusions, so long as you're willing to argue it out in good faith.
I don't think the Founding Fathers, and maybe they did just in a different sense, had quite the Twitter mob, I'll call it, that when you step forward to try to reach across the aisle to speak to someone, and someone on the other side, particularly if somebody on the left, if they say somebody on the right has a valid point, the mob comes at you. And it seems hard to hear the clear, focused conversation of discourse among the screaming mob. And so where do we find the space in our world to put forth those conversations?
It is funny, isn't it, that mm-hmm. what I take to be a fairly moderate and even boring proposal, which right. is, hey, let's try to argue this out, is viewed as a radical proposal worth some, you know, shock and awe.
Right. Yeah.
This is the most boring document I think I've ever written, and mm-hmm. I'm shocked that people can disagree with it, and yet they do. You know, I would say two things. First, it takes a little bit of courage to not bow and kowtow before the Twitter mob. And one bit of courage might simply be to not have Twitter and to not pay attention to it. Mm-hmm. But to mm-hmm. not be afraid of the ire of others. There's a real virtue to be had there, political courage. Second, I think we need to remind ourselves, and it would be helpful if we could remind some of our opponents of this, that if politics isn't like religion, if it's not totalizing, compromise is not a sin. You know, in religion, compromise can, in fact, be a sin. I am unwilling, you know, I'm an Orthodox Roman Catholic. I'm unwilling to compromise on the Nicene Creed. It is what it is. It's the foundation of the doctrine of the faith, the deposit of the faith. I can't compromise on that. Mm-hmm. But I really can compromise on tax policy. If I can get some good, I don't have to get the perfect good politically. So long as I'm not formally cooperating with evil, any movement towards the good is good enough for me. And that's how democratic policies work. That's how a liberal democracy works. We're not going to get everything we want. People of good conscience and goodwill disagree with us. If I can give a little and get a little, in politics, that seems no sin to me.
You talk about core commitments, marriage, religion, education, justice. How do these shape the conversation in what you're talking about, kind of a fusion or a conversation of compromise?
You know, I keep using the example of tax policy because in some ways that's something that arises ire. I live in New Jersey. I know all about high taxes. I would like them to be less. But there are nonetheless more important things at times for us to focus the core of our energies on. And when I look at progressivism just now or identity politics, I see that it's not just on the margins of political discourse that they're burrowing in and sapping and undermining the republic. It's at the core institutions, things like marriage. If you undermine the family, not only does that have disastrous effects on things like religion, human happiness, and children, it also undermines the republic. No family, no republic. Mm-hmm. So too with religious freedom. It's remarkable to me that in a nation like the United States, where I'm an immigrant to, I'm Canadian, I came here in part because of its deep commitment to religious freedom, the sense that conscience of the individual was the bedrock of the political consensus. Well, that's clearly under attack. And if that disappears, so too does the republic. Education. If we lose our children, and we are losing our children, whatever people decide about how to educate their children, I do not judge. They go to public school, private school, what have you, that's fine. They judge their own family life. But I do know that the educational establishment and the colleges which teach our teachers are not our friends when it comes to things like religion and family and the common good. And if we don't get education right, we will in fact lose the next generation and have a very difficult time maintaining our form of life. And of course, justice. The rule of law, if it is about anything, is about common justice and the basics of the dignity which is required for human beings to live in keeping as their status as children and images of God. If we lose that, what's the point of having a polity without justice? So those aren't the exclusive considerations or concerns, but they seem to us to be the core ones that we need to get right and we better figure out.
That's an extensive list and well covers many of the issues deep in our society. The hardest thought I have in listening to that list is how do we untangle ourselves from this? We have let this drift down a path of not caring or being concerned, oh, that's just what they teach kids in college, and that's not real. The conservatives have had this thought that it didn't really matter, but we're kind of seeing the results of turning a blind eye to saying something didn't matter for now a generation or two. How do you untangle that, particularly the issue of education? Because in a lot of ways, education, a good platform and correcting that will correct many of our other ills going forward.
And RJ, one of the things you talked about was deformation of the language, too, of how that has been a very insidious factor in the educating of our young people, and especially the educating of our young people in values, is this absolute just transformation and deforming of the language.
Yeah, the chickens are home to roost, right? We were not minding the shop. I'm going to use a bunch of cliches here. The horse is out of the barn.
There we go.
You can think of about education is true. You know, the image that I like to use is that of a kind of ne'er-do-well trust fund baby who has been spending down the family capital for a generation. And we've discovered that it's easier to spend religious and educational capital than it is to build it up once it's gone. If we don't pay attention to education, the rest of our battles will be, you know, tempests and teapots, because the moral imagination and deepest commitments of our young will be warped, including with the policing of language. If we can't speak, or if we're not allowed to think in certain terms, that the reality which that language reveals and manifests will no longer be present or available to us. Language does, in fact, mediate reality. If you control the language, you control thought. If you control thought, you control the options that people imagine as being open to them. Just as an example, so I teach at Princeton University as a visiting instructor. I was speaking to one of my students in one of my classes yesterday, and he remarked to me, remember, this is Princeton. Mm-hmm. This is one of the elite colleges of not just the nation, but the world. These should be free people, right? They're getting a remarkable education, a remarkable opportunity. And he told me that in class, he never speaks his mind because he's afraid of what that would mean for his friendships and his future and his employment. That's outrageous, because not only is he not being courageous, eventually, it's quite likely that he not only will not speak his mind, but his mind will be changed by the narrowing of options presented to him through the control of language and the control of thought. Now, how to solve that? Well, there's all sorts of good colleges out there, University of Dallas, Hillsdale, etc. Thomas Aquinas, you fill in your preference. There's all sorts of wonderful programs within larger universities. I'm thinking of the Arete Initiative at Duke, or the James Madison Program here at Princeton, or the Collegium Institute at Penn. The list could go on and on. But more than anything, I would remind parents, and increasingly I would remind grandparents. I'll say this for grandparents. Mm-hmm. Retirement is not an option for you just now when it comes to your grandchildren's education. Mm-hmm. The church reminds us that parents are the primary teachers of their children. The schools teach at our bequest and with our permission. And if you're a parent or a grandparent, if you don't know what your children or grandchildren are being taught, and if you are not supplementing that at home and on the weekends and through your own form of life, I think you will have some hard questions asked of you by your children in the future.
It's true. Maybe the silver lining of this pandemic is a lot of students and young adults have gone back to the family home to hunker down and work from home. And they have been continued to be exposed to some of these values in the family and to see them lived out. So now when they go back out, they're going to be a little more mindful of what is put in their ears and stuff. And I've seen it happen in my family. And it's this small sliver of hope that you see out of this whole 2021 experience that we have going on.
You know, we know that not all families are perfect, and mm-hmm. some are deeply unhappy. And yet, the institution of the family is the best means that we have in reality to form value and to form decent people. It's no surprise that progressives and others wish to take children away from parents and family as much as possible. Getting them into family, assuming that it's, you know, moderately functioning, is always better than handing them over to those who wish to deform our children's minds.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. It's true. It's true. And I tell you, one of the things that's happening, because I live in Europe, as everybody knows now, and I'm still on, you know, in this hostage crisis of lockdown. But one of the things I'm seeing here in Europe is a kind of a stacking, a repudiation of what is coming across the Atlantic for that woke left ideology. Macron has stood up, the president of France has stood up to it, Angela Merkel has stood up to it. And what they're saying is we don't want this on our shores. And the reason why they don't want it on their shores is because I think numerous reasons. President Macron is running against a very right-wing candidate, Marie Le Pen. But one of the reasons why they don't want this on the shores is because it has the potential to destroy fundamental elements within their society. And their societies that are much more traditional cannot turn on a dime if these fundamental structures are destroyed. So it's a real interesting thing to watch in the news over here in Germany.
It's funny, my friends and I, you know, I'm a philosopher by training, so, you know, I'm no good to anybody. But one of the jokes that my friends and I have been making is, for 70 years, the French exported to us the worst ideas of existentialism and postmodern theories. They gave us Foucault and Derrida and Lyotard and Sartre. And the American university embraced those ideas so thoroughly and now is beginning to export back the children and grandchildren of French thought, and the French say, no thanks.
Right? That's right. That's exactly what's happening.
You know, there's a hilarious perversity to the whole thing. You know, it is fascinating to look at, particularly in Eastern Europe, societies that have some problems with understanding liberty as an American would understand it. But the Hungarians and the Poles are thinking through the implications of late liberalism or postmodern liberalism, whatever you want to call it, in a way that we're just waking up to. And increasingly, so are the French and the Germans. And it'll be fascinating to see if there will be a new wave of ideas and theories coming from Europe, which could help correct the contemporary American excess. Wouldn't that be fascinating?
Yes, it would be.
Well, I give kudos to them as individual countries not giving up their sovereignty to this idea of the collective idea of the EU. And you do see that pushback, particularly in Hungary and Poland, on issues of family and life that they are standing very strong on. And I was pleasantly surprised to see what President Macron was doing in France of pushing back on this idea. Plus, I think they're a little bit scared to get this kind of wokeness on their shores is going to just upend their society. And they've got a percolating situation over there regularly anyway.
Dr. Snell, you're the new editor-in-chief of Public Discourse. Besides this invitation that we've talked about extensively during this interview, where do you see public discourse going in the future? We interview many public discourse authors. They're kind of a staple for our morning show because their ideas are very clear. They're always very succinct, very articulate. Do you see a new direction of public discourse going?
Well, our basic commitments are going to be the same. We value reason. We value the truth-seeking function of debate. We're committed to the basic institutions of society and rebuilding those up. So you're going to see similar articles about marriage and education and politics and justice and law and so on. That will continue. And I hope in a similar way of rigor and charitable rigor, right? Intelligence and love combined. Mm-hmm. Well, one of the ideas that we're hunkering down on is the following. At a moment of crisis, like many people feel just now, crisis just means that a judgment needs to be made. There's confusion and a judgment needs to be made. Many people have forgotten some of the basic commitments of a Republican form of life. And we'll be launching a series which is kind of back to the basics. What is the human person? What is the family? What is the point of sexuality? What's natural law? What does it mean to be a democratic polity? But not in a way which simply tries to wind back the clock as if there are no new problems. So we'll be doing a primer, back to the basics, which has as its primary motivation a kind of creative fidelity, right, or creative retrieval. We go back to central principles. We never compromise on basic moral truths, but those moral truths are not ossified and arthritic. They're capable of being ever new and ever alive because they're true. So we'll be hunkering down in some ways with basic truths of human reality and articulating how those truths are still alive and can answer the questions of today.
We've been speaking with Dr. R.J. Snell. He is the editor-in-chief of The Public Discourse, and you can check out their work on thepublicdiscourse.com. Smart Conversations. Right, Michelle? She's always sending me links to your stuff, doctor.
Well, appreciate that, Michelle. Thank you.
Your stuff is the clearest out there, though. I mean, there's a couple of journals, of key journals, but Public Discourse, actually, you nail it because the writing is good, the logic is good, the arguments are good, and that is so needed right now.
Thank you very much. Yeah, we think people should educate themselves, and we're trying to offer the best we can to assist with that.
Well, Dr. Snell, we wish you great success as becoming, stepping into the shoes as editor-in-chief and continuing another decade or two of great work at the Public Discourse.
Thank you so much, Ellen. Thanks, Michelle.
Great. Appreciate it here. Michelle, we hope that you're going to survive the next week here. Good days ahead. I hear rumors you might be trying to escape and get back to the homeland for a bit. I'm Ellen Taylor. You've been listening to Convergence, a podcast courtesy of Archangel Media. And you can find the podcast on our website, archangelradio.com, or Spotify, or where you find your favorite podcasts available. We look forward to speaking with you next time on Convergence.